It's a big anniversary for Canadian rockers Wide Mouth Mason. The 20th anniversary reissue of Stu, and Sean Vero from the band is here to talk about it now. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Jerry.
Oh, I should say happy anniversary. Maybe that's the better way to start it, right?
It's a happy occasion for us. It's a little bit of a head spinner that it was 20 years ago that we made this record, Stu, but yeah, it's fun to revisit. It's like when you look in the mirror and go, oh, every day I don't notice that my hair is longer. But if you look after 20 years, quite a bit has changed.
Lots has changed, even just in terms of the music business itself, right? You know, recording music and then getting it out there. So much has changed.
Oh, man. When we were, we probably spent more on tape making Stew than we did on our last couple records. It's really amazing the revolution of easily accessible stuff that you have that makes it so that you can record amazing sounding projects anywhere cheaply, and you're basically just limited by your imagination now. Anything you can think of, you can realize relatively quickly, which puts the weight on how good are your ideas if you could do anything. So yeah, it's definitely changed. And we were making CDs back then. There was you could do gigs. It was a totally different world 20 years ago.
Yeah. When you guys were limited, and not just you guys, but anybody in the recording industry was limited in terms of your exposure, right? I mean, you had, you know, in Canada, we had Much Music for videos, and you had to depend heavily on record labels. And now it's, you know, it's social media. You almost don't even need that whole sort of business side because people are finding ways to monetize on their own. So even that element has changed.
It's really different. It's been like the explosion of, you know, when there was network television and there were three channels.
Right.
There was some really special things that were able to happen. Like, you know, all those people who saw it remembering seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show simultaneously, where now it's so spread out that millions of people can be into niche things that millions of other people have never heard of before. And, you know, the onus is on the music listener, anyone who's going, oh, there isn't any good music these days, just hasn't been looking, because there's such a variety of things for every taste that are available now that you don't just go to, you know, the music store and see what's on the shelves. You have access to hear basically anything that's ever been recorded whenever you feel like it.
Yeah, and for everybody listening, that's how old Sean is that there were only three channels when he was growing up. At least for me, there was channel 2 to 13. We had 2 to 13 when I was growing up, so there you go.
That's right. I'm of an earlier vintage, and one of them was the French channel, so, you know, you just watch what was on. And in a way, that was when I had 5 records, I knew those 5 records intimately. I knew every sonic millimeter of those records, where now, you know, the fact that you have everything, it's become real common for people not even to listen to an entire song. Just, oh, here's a bit of that. Yeah, that's how that one's doing. Let me switch to another song that I'll listen to just the beginning of. So
yeah.
I think we're on the cusp of still coming from album culture. I still like the prolonged narrative arc of a record and how one song goes into the next one and how it influences the way it sounds. So I think that Stu era of around 2000 was like the last little bit of physical records before it all became streaming and downloading.
And you know what I miss? I mean, I appreciate the streaming and downloading, but what I miss was, I remember in high school when there was the new, being from Winnipeg, for me, I knew, like, when Chantal Kreviazuk had a new CD coming out. I remember skipping high school that morning, going in the rain downtown Winnipeg on the bus, and it was HMV or A&B Sound at the time, even. And, you know, and then there was something, I had my Discman with me, and then, you know, reading all the liner notes and the pictures and then listening to it on my Discman on the way home. Like, you just don't get that. Now I go at midnight and press a button to download, right?
Yeah, and there's no more, you know, you don't have additional things, where it used to be almost a part of your wardrobe and your identity for a summer. This is our record this summer, and it would like a dog-eared book. It would follow you around and be part of your life experience for a while. And yeah, now you don't, your phone doesn't get bigger when you put a new album on it, so everything kind of stays the same. And but there's still been, I still feel like I go through periods of like fall, I listen to a lot of jazz and a lot of Hendrix usually, and you know, other periods will be like, well, summer feels like these types of songs. So Stu was very much, to me, even though it's funky and summery in some places, it's a good headphone fall record, for, you know, when around this time of year when things smell a certain way or they feel a certain way, that it's the little ear candy things that we did for when you're cozy in the evening and have your headphones on and can pick out, oh, the keyboard part's doing that in the back. It's our most layered record up until that point, where we'd really done just three-piece style recording, and maybe we would add you know, an organ or something before. But when we started going down the path of Stu and recognizing that this was going to be our Stevie Wonderist, our Princest record, that a lot of the style and era correct stuff would mean that there would be some different clavinets and percussion and different vocal arrangements and stuff. So it's a good time to cozy up with some headphones and check out all the stuff that's going on underneath.
It's a fresh Stew. It's not stale.
Stew's always better the next day when all the ingredients have had a while to get to know each other. So maybe the same is true after 20 years.
I think it's fitting, right? Because, you know, with American Thanksgiving here, and, you know, it's a nice, it's a hearty, it's a warm, like you say, we're getting ready for the winter season. I think it's perfect timing.
Warm up your inner.
let's rewind a bit. I guess the band's been together, well, it's 25 years now for the band then, right?
Yeah. Well, since our very first record came out in 96 or 97, all that time has passed. Our drummer, Seth Wan, was actually the first other musician that I ever played with, going back to, you know, being 12 years old and me playing an acoustic and he playing pots and pans, and then eventually graduating up to his parents, found a drum. It's like a guy was retiring from playing drums, and he sold them every piece of percussion along with a drum kit that he had. So I would go to Saf's place, and in his basement, all of a sudden there was this like Neil Peart 100-piece kit with tuned cowbells and cymbals and rototoms, and he just had this massive, I think there was a gong behind it, like a massive John Bonham kit. And we would just sweat ourselves through whatever we were wearing, jamming and making stuff up, and wrote a lot of our future songs in that basement of just jamming. And when Earl, our original bassist, entered the picture, then you know, he'd be wearing his fast food outfit from having to go to work after, and Saf would be dressed in his coveralls from working for the city, and I'd have a tie on from working at a music store selling guitars, and we'd all get together and just jam and make it all up. And then that led to us playing shows and starting to get out and doing club shows, and word of mouth for our live shows spread, and we started opening bigger and bigger gigs. And then, you know, a few years later, we found ourselves in LA opening for AC/DC and toured with the Stones and ZZ Top and a bunch of our heroes, and it's been an amazing ride. But it always comes back to those jams in the basement, just three people turning on the amps and going, okay, what's gonna happen, what are we gonna make up today? And we're still chasing that, we're still following that all these years later, trying to come up with something that makes us excited to play together. And we sure miss doing it live in front of people, but looking forward to when that's a thing again.
You know, it's one thing to have a childhood back in that day, because I remember doing things. I mean, I wasn't into music or playing music, but I did musical theater in school, and there was just this creative element where, you know, you'd make things with construction paper. Now, you know, you're drawing things with an app, right? Your finger on your phone is drawing things. And it seems like creativity has really shifted since we were growing up then.
Yes, definitely. You can realize and get something out very quickly now, and I think the part of what home recording and that kind of thing has done is has made the recording process much more casual. I think back in the day when we knew we were making a record, we'd write and get ready for it, and then we'd go live in the studio for a month. And learning the studio is kind of like learning how to play an instrument. And if you only get access to that instrument, you know, for a month every year and a half, the things that you learn and put into practice, if it's another year and a half before you go back again, can kind of leave you. You get out of touch with them. And I think now people are, I record a lot in this closet that I'm sitting on the floor of while we're speaking, and the red light being on and knowing your recording stops freaking you out after you do it enough times, and you just get that main line to your first thought and your best idea being the quickest one. So right before this Stew reissue, we made a new record called I Want to Go With You, and the method of recording it was very much that. Let's just have a sketch of basically how the song goes, but get in and record it really quickly without thinking too much, and just let it be a performance that we capture that has an element of surprise and improvisation in it, where we're just seeing what happens when you're just in that place where you know the song, but you don't know exactly what you're going to do, and there's room for spontaneous invention. Where the Stew sessions were more about us listening to old vinyl records and going, okay, if we're really going to explore this funky side of the band, what do we need to work out the groove science of, if the drummer's doing this, the guitar has to do exactly this so that they weave together and make this piece so that they play different roles and fill the space and work together well. So it's interesting. Yeah, for every record you make, there's a totally different process available to you for it.
Let's go from recording now to touring, because you name dropped, and I love a name dropper because I'm one myself. But how does it work though? Because I've always wondered how, you know, how did Britney Spears find that person, or how did, you know, Cher or Backstreet Boys, or, as you know, Rolling Stones, and a how does that happen? Did they hear your music? Does somebody put it in front of them? How did it work in your case?
In our case, for touring opportunities, some of it would come down to an agent going, look, I have this young band, you know, can we put them on before the opener and see how it goes? And if it goes well, can they open some more dates? And we've definitely had managers dragging people from the headlining band and haranguing them and just being, you have to see my band, you have to see my band open. And that was how we ended up touring with the band Big Sugar when our first record came out. Is our manager at the time just pestered Gordy and out of his dressing room and took him to see us, and he went, you know what, you're right, I love this band, what are they doing for the next month and a half? Because if they're not doing anything, they're opening for us touring across Canada. So that happened, and then word would spread, and we got a gig opening for George Thorogood in the States, and that got us comfortable playing big theaters. And then word that we did well enough on that spread, and we ended up opening for ZZ Top in Canada in arenas. And you play your first arena, and kind of, it's like jumping out of an airplane. Before you know it, it's over, and you barely remember it happening, but it was a rush while it happened. And we did well enough on that. There were a couple Cinderella situations where, you know, the Stones were booked to play in Canada, and then there was an ice storm, and they had to reschedule the shows. And when they were rescheduled for, the original opening band couldn't do it, and word had gotten around that we were, a band that did well in front of audiences that didn't know who we were, and that we were three dudes from Saskatchewan who, you know, got out of the way when the crew said to, and finished when the set was supposed to be over, and one by one those opportunities just started happening. We get the AC/DC tour, Slash had pulled out of being the opener with the Snake Pit, and we got a call, and we had just finished a really long tour and were headed home for a break, and we got a call saying, if you can be in Florida the day after tomorrow, you can open a couple of AC/DC shows, and if it goes well, because that crowd is not easy on opening bands, so if it goes well enough, you can open probably a week of shows. And it just went well enough that they said, okay, you're gonna do this for the next 2 months, just travel around and every day or every second day open a show for AC/DC in an arena. So yeah, it goes back to those small gigs when you're just starting off and transitioning from the basement to a club, and then you kind of figure out how that works, and then you go from a club to a theater and figure out how to fill the room and how to project to the back of the room and make people pay attention. And it just feels like the arc of it was a real steady, logical one for us. And the rooms that we got comfortable playing in got bigger, and we just put more in our arsenal of, okay, we can figure out how to do this. How about a jazz festival in a country you've never played before? Okay, we can figure out how to do that. You just pile one thing on top of another, and before you know it, it's a couple decades later.
Now, my next question to follow up on that is, and I'm fairly certain the Stones and AC/DC are not listening to me on the radio, so it's just between us, Sean, is what happened? Like, do you guys get to hang out with the band, or is it kind of one of those, we're just the opening, so we need to stay in our corner? Tell me, give me a juicy story from the road.
Either of those situations can happen, and we know what it's like to be the headlining band where, you know, all day you're doing press and preparation and sound checking, and usually that 40 minutes or whatever that an opening band is on for is your only break, whether you're gonna chill or play your instrument or talk to your family back home. While the opener is on is your chance. So we have no hard feelings for any band that we've ever played with that we didn't get a chance to hang out with. And we would hope that they would understand that sometimes we can't always come hang out with them when they're opening for us. But in the case of the Stones and ZZ Top and AC/DC, every one of them was generous with, especially the tours that went on for a long time. You know, when you just do one date with someone, sometimes you just get the photo op to prove that it happened. But in all of those cases, you know, Brian Johnson showed up in our dressing room a couple shows in and went, hey, happy to have you aboard, lads. We're going to go to a restaurant, eat later, and hang out and get to know each other. And very quickly they extended, you know, if you ever need anything, let us know. The Stones, I remember a couple run-ins. One, I had stayed on stage after our sound check just to drool on Keith's guitars and amps and Ronnie's guitars, and the rest of the band went to the catering area to eat, and I was still checking the gear out, so I was a bit behind and went, okay, I'll just follow my nose to where it smells like there's food. And went, well, this is the nicest restaurant I've ever been in all of a sudden, and it's backstage in an arena. There's a gigantic ice sculpture of the Rolling Stones Lips logo. It's smelling delicious. I wonder if this is the area I'm supposed to be in. And I turned a corner, and another human turned a corner and stepped on my feet. Like, we turned the corner, and our faces almost bumped into each other. And I realized that my lips were an inch away from the biggest lips in rock and roll, and I was about to smash noses with Mick Jagger. And then I felt this hand on the scruff of my neck picking me up, lifting me up, going, do you eat over there in the general eating area? This is the Stones' private catered area, and this is secure. And so we thought, okay, that's fine. And then a couple of shows later, Charlie Watts showed up in our dressing room and went, hey, you're going to eat in our area tonight. And they kindly invited us back there to hang out with them. So, yeah, the first tour we did was ZZ Top. We saw them for a photo op at the end. And then the last time we toured with them in 2010 or so, halfway through our first soundcheck, Billy Gibbons was on stage starting the hang and chatting, and for a couple of weeks we and him were inseparable and traveled the country going to places to have food and drinks and hearing stories and sharing tales of the road and just basking in his awesome Gibbonsness. He was just warm and hospitable and told stories and showed us guitars and was amazing to us. So we've been very lucky.
You know, isn't it? It's nice to take a walk down memory lane, given the kind of year that this was, right? With all of the, you know, we've had protests and riots and virus and everything. And the presidential election is still, you know, it's nice to have these memories of times gone by that were just so great, isn't it?
It is. Your brain filters all the nice stuff when you're looking back on those things, but it sure will be nice to commune again and be in each other's presence and to make loud music together and just that feeling of when a whole room is moving together in a common purpose is a beautiful thing, and we sure miss that. And I mean, there's lots of beauty and wonder to be found now, and it's like when you have a kid and you're in the diaper era, it feels like all you're ever going to do is change diapers, and then the short couple years later, you kind of remember the diaper era.
Remember,
right. You know, I used to change a lot of diapers, but I'm not haunted by it. It's not my whole world anymore. Somehow it moved on, and this will do the same thing. You know, in a few years, we'll remember that we all watched all of Netflix and ate like crazy and had to lock down and miss shows and we'll feel nice that it's moved on and hopefully to a better place.
Well, I think the good way to wrap up the year is to listen to some classic tunes, right, that take you back. And so, as we mentioned, Stu, it's the 20th anniversary re-release. It's due out later this month, right? November 27th, I believe, yeah?
That's right.
All right, and we're going to keep in touch with the band, social media and website, right? You guys are always on there.
Yeah, we're constantly staying in contact. I tend to post a lot of videos of myself playing guitar and sometimes singing and either songs that we're working through or revisiting or reinterpreting. So, yeah, I try and keep it interesting so it's not just, hey, everyone, check out our record, although we love when you do that. So, yeah, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Wide Mouth Mason, and the website is widemouthmason.com, and decades and decades of music for you to get to know if you haven't heard us yet.
Absolutely. Well, Sean, thanks so much for joining us, and again, happy anniversary to you.
Thanks.